Welcome to the House of Brick Partner podcast. I am Bob Lindquist. The intent of this podcast is to share, educate, and advise listeners on best practices for business critical database platforms and related technologies. Today, we are joined by David Woodard, executive license consultant and one of the founders of House of Brick Technologies. David, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here, Bob.
Well, David, you and I have been working, I think, going on almost 9 years. Obviously, you've been at House of Brick almost 25 years since things got started. I've always found we felt Oracle's had pretty great technologies over the years, and I think we're seeing a lot of changes over the years. What's your take on Oracle, probably in the first 20 or so years on their technologies?
Yeah, we've always loved the technologies from Oracle, you know, database, applications, server, you know, solid products, industry leading. I think, you know, in the past 10 years or so, SQL Server's definitely caught up and is an equal competitor now with right. Oracle. But, you know, the thing is always when you talk about Oracle with customers, they talk about Oracle licensing and audits. And that's always the pain point for customers with Oracle.
Right. Right. I agree. I think the licensing advisory services we provide over the last 5 or 6 years has been some of the fastest growing, right?
It has. Yeah.
And for today's conversation, we're going to talk a little about Java. And you can't mention Java without thinking about Sun Microsystems. I know I was involved indirectly with them 15, 20 plus years ago. They also had great technologies, right? They were part of the .com, you know, time and an original contributor to open source projects, Java being one of those. How did Sun originally position Java with customers, you know, in those days?
Well, actually, remember being briefed on Java for a company I worked for back in 1994. It was just coming out, and I if I recall correctly, I think their slogan back then was "Write once, run anywhere." And so, you know, the intent was to be a universal platform for code and programs that could run on, you know, nobody would have thought at the time, but smartphones and any other type of platform.
Right, right. And then fast forward to 2009, Oracle's in its acquisition mode, purchasing a lot of different software vendors, hardware vendors. They picked up Sun for its hardware and software, particularly Java. How did Oracle then start positioning Sun technology, specifically Java, to customers?
Well, you know, during that time, after the acquisition, of course, they were, you know, pushing Sun hardware quite a bit, and they still have, you know, a line today that derives from that. But Java, you know, was just kind of still out there. They kept developing, kept coming out with new versions, and it was always free to use, and customers used it. And, you know, I think Oracle, as any vendor who had a product like that would, wanted it to be out there as far reaching as possible on every platform that they could get it on.
Right. Yeah, and I think, you know, what we've seen, you mentioned Oracle licensing and audits earlier. You know, now fast forward to the last few years, what's kind of changed in how Oracle's positioning specifically Java and how customers use Java?
Well, obviously in, you know, 2018, Oracle announced they're going to start charging for Java subscription-based model. And, you know, we absolutely agree with any vendor's right to charge for their product. There's nothing wrong with that. They made an investment a long time ago in Sun. And quite frankly, I'm surprised they didn't start charging for it sooner. And, you know, the subscriptions are reasonable. And then, you know, in 2018, again, they announced that. And then 2019, it's easy to remember, April 15th, tax day 2019.
Right.
Any update put out on that date or after used for commercial production purposes requires a subscription. And there are a few exceptions to that we'll chat about.
Right. So what I hear you saying is Oracle was trying to rationalize how Java would fit. How it could be used, how it could quote unquote be licensed or subscribed for. I'm trying to think of how we work, excuse me, with a number of our clients in regards to Oracle, and they also have Java. What are some of the use cases for Java? You mentioned kind of that slogan of write once, deploy anywhere. How are you seeing many of our clients use Java today?
Well, one of the obvious ones is on the server side, Java application servers, Oracle's WebLogic, Internet Application Server, and you know, those type of products that run on the server side. and use Java to serve up Java applications that the customers either have written or have purchased from third parties. And the other realm is the workstation side of things. Java is used in a lot of different applications. I have a PDF editor, runs on Java. I happen to run Linux on my desktop because it's Java based. I can run that product on any operating system. So lots of use out there, lots of server side use. Third party independent software vendors have written a lot of software that uses Java on the server side and on the workstation side.
Okay. And you mentioned smartphones earlier, but mainly Java's kind of centered really around, as you said, the server side or the desktop itself.
Yeah. And, you know, in the smartphone area, of course, we had the Google versus Oracle lawsuit over Google's essentially re-implementation of Java, you know, and that could fill an entire podcast on its own. So we'll leave that topic for now.
And that doesn't really relate here. Like you said, it's separate related to Google technologies. But, you know, you mentioned a couple of years ago in 2019, the Java license changes. Can you elaborate a little further? What specifically changed? I believe we have a blog or two on some of those topics.
Sure. If you're going to use Oracle's JDK for commercial production purposes, you generally will require an annual subscription. And the subscription is actually listed in the Java price list. Oracle is one of the few vendors that publishes their price list, and we do appreciate that. But if you go look up the Oracle Java price list, you'll see two items in there. One is processor-based license, which is for servers, and then named user license, which is for workstations. And while it's listed in there as a monthly subscription, it's purchased annually. So it comes out to, at the lowest tiers of volume, $30 a year for a workstation and $300 a year for a processor. Mm-hmm. And you do get to use the core factor. And we'll talk a little bit more about how Java is purchased and what the agreements in place are. But Oracle does use the Oracle Master Agreement, which has the processor definition and the processor core factor table.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So how does that interrelate, if at all, in terms of how a customer is purchasing, say, database technologies or the core technology set of Oracle on their database platform versus Java? Is that licensing identical? Are they part of the same agreement? How does that work?
Yeah, so what will happen there, again, with the core factor table, people who have currently Oracle technology stack, database, middleware, they're used to the core factor table. And the short version is, for Intel and AMD, you use a 0.5 core factor. So if I have an 8-core server multiplied by 0.5, I only have to purchase 4 processor licenses. So the licensing model is pretty much the same. What we've seen is when customers purchase a subscription from Oracle, it'll be an ordering document that is written against an existing Oracle Master Agreement that the customer already has in place if they have the Oracle, technology stack.
Right.
Or if they don't, they'll sign a new OMA with Oracle. But the base contract seems to be the same for Java as it is for the other Oracle products.
Okay. And is there such a thing? I know we mentioned Oracle audits in passing. Do Oracle audits include Java? Are they separate in terms of just a Java audit? Or what's kind of going on with Oracle customers today? What have we seen with our clients?
Java audits are a little bit new. In 2019, Oracle started charging for Java. And they have been fairly aggressive in contacting customers, asking them to essentially true up or get Java purchased. And of course, the customers need to. We compare it to the IRS. You should pay all the taxes that you owe, but not a penny more. But as far as Java audits go, we've not seen a customer be audited for Java through to completion. Oftentimes, when you get an audit notice from Oracle, it will say all Oracle products. But then sometimes during the scoping of that audit up front, Oracle may say, hey, we're focusing on this, we're focusing on that. Mm-hmm. So we haven't yet seen a Java audit that has gone all the way through. So, and one of the big issues there is discovering Java, which we can, we'll talk about further.
Yeah, on that point, so, we've talked about some of the use cases for Java. I think you may have even said, antivirus vendors should, incorporate that into their software. to determine how Java is deployed. What have you seen, you know, Oracle customers do, or just Java in general, how it's being used? How have those customers validated their usage of Java?
So, you know, that's the difficulty, is discovering Java. Where do I have it installed? It's been free since its inception, so it's everywhere. You know, I might download a workstation product and unzip it, and Java comes along with it. Now that will have stopped happening since you know, April of 2019. But prior to that, a vendor might just ship it with their product.
Right.
And so I might unzip it on my Windows workstation, and it never goes through the Windows installer to be registered as an installed program. So yeah, how do I find it? So, you know, you've got Java sitting out there on a lot of different file systems, a lot of Windows workstations, Windows servers, Linux servers, and so forth. So discovery is the big issue. Where is it? And what is it? Which versions is it? So we've had different customers do different things. SCCM on the Microsoft side to search servers and workstations for java.exe. Fortunately, in the Windows realm, it has a known extension of .exe. When we get into the Linux side, it does not. It's just Java as an executable.
Right.
So, you know, you could write some shell scripts, do some finds, but where we've seen some customers have some success is in a couple of areas. One, they may already have some software asset management tools in place.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a Flexera or IBM Big Fix or something like that. And they've already got an inventory of everything on their workstations and servers. And a lot of these tools don't just check with the software registry on the system. They actually search the file system for these things. So those have been very helpful and can produce reports pretty easily. The other area, interestingly enough, is your security team. If they're running, say, a Qualys or Tenable security scanner across all your systems, and they're scanning at the file system level, which they often do, you might ask, we've had a couple of customers who've asked their security team, and they said, oh yeah, we can tell you where all the Java versions are because we scan for that, because we need to know what the vulnerabilities are in specific versions, and we need to, you know, either report on that or mitigate that. So we already know where all the Java is.
Right. What I hear you saying then, David, is there's really not been a uniform way for customers to validate where Java is deployed. Perhaps their security group might have some tools that can assist. I know here at House of Brick, we have our Ops Compass suite, where in our license manager, we may, in our roadmap, look at including Java as part of our license manager. But really, it's still somewhat a manual process, perhaps multiple tools. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's correct. Yeah, I've seen in doing Java assessments for customers, oftentimes they'll get two separate files, one that came out of a Windows-based product like SCCM for all their Windows real estate, and a different tool for the Linux side of things. It might be a security scanner or some other tool that they have that manages that. So yeah, it can be multiple tools. The big question is too, when Oracle starts auditing Java, what is Oracle going to use for a discovery tool? You know, we have no idea what that's going to look like. If maybe they're writing one, working on one, we don't know.
Right. So you mentioned Java assessments. What has House of Brick done with Java assessments? How does that work? And what's that process, whether the customer does it themselves or brings in a third party like House of Brick?
Yeah, so the basic, you know, if you want to assess where you're at with Java, and, you know, it's always been difficult with Oracle products to determine your own compliance. You know, the database side, you've got all the options and packs you might stumble into usage of. Java is a little bit simpler. Java is either there or it's not, and it is of a specific version and update number. So, again, the big step is discovery. But once you've got a list of all your Java installations, what you really want is, you know, obviously the server that it's installed on, and that can be a virtual machine. And we'll talk about things like VMware here in a little bit. But the second thing you want is the full version down to the release number. So I might have Java 8 update 227. I need to know that update number because there's a point where you have to start paying for Java at a specific update. And then I also want to know, is it actually the Oracle JDK, or is it OpenJDK? OpenJDK does not require a license, a purchase of a license, but it's updated less frequently than the Oracle JDK. So once you have those things, then you can essentially start, whittling your data down. I can remove OpenJDK. I can remove older versions of Oracle that don't require a subscription. And now what I'm left with is those OpenJDK versions that are of a specific update that does require a subscription. And now I start looking at what hardware are they on and counting processors.
Right. And at that point, that just puts you in a position to defend yourself, or at least understand perhaps you need to maybe purchase some licenses to be in a quote unquote compliant state.
Correct. And, you know, one of the other things to note is Java is still free for development use, even in a commercial environment. Okay. So the other thing you need to understand is on those servers on which it's installed, what type of environment is that? So
yeah, you mentioned VMware earlier, David. How does that relate here?
Well, you know, Oracle makes the same argument with VMware and Java licensing that they do with their other products. Oracle will tell you have to license your entire set of VMware servers across your entire environment. Even if you keep Java within, say, a 2-node cluster, and you've got 30 other nodes out there in different clusters, Oracle will tell you need to license all 32. And that's not correct. That's not borne out by the contract. It says you must count the processors where the software is installed and or running. So, you know, that also could potentially be a separate topic unto itself, but that's the gist of it. But what you can do when you start doing your self-evaluation is figure out, do I want to constrain Java to a specific set of servers to reduce my footprint and my cost?
Right.
Do I have a cluster of 20 servers, with several hundred processors in that cluster, and I have one Java virtual machine in that cluster? I'd probably look at moving that someplace else to a much smaller cluster, things like that. I can look at that and see what I need my footprint to be and what do I really need to purchase here.
Got it. And for Oracle audits, we've been working with one of our strategic partners, Tactical Law Group. I think even recently we've been involved in some Java licensing discussions. What perspective has Tactical Law Group had in regards to Java and Java licensing?
Oh, it's been good. You work a lot with Pam Fulmer over at Tactical Law Group. She's actually written a blog, and we've republished it on the House of Brick website, talking about the agreements. As I myself might talk about Oracle contracts and things, talk about the technical side of them. And you'll hear me say, consult with your counsel on this as well. And right. Pam's always been really good. She's got a good technical understanding of this. But one of the areas is, if I haven't yet purchased Java from Oracle and signed an Oracle Master Agreement, what contract governs my use of Java today?
True.
Well, it's the ClickWrap agreement that you click through when you download Java. And Pam's got a good blog that discusses that.
Okay. Good. Well, some good information. Sun kind of, I think, had it right up front in terms of, having Java, as an open source, package, and then Oracle acquires them, rationalizes how they do it. Oracle, especially trying to drive cloud revenue and other revenue with some of their on-premise licensing and hardware revenue not going up any longer. Sounds like they're trying to make Java, I want to say, a cash cow, but trying to grab, nickels and dimes where they can.
Yeah, I think so. They've got we're seeing a very large email marketing campaign from Oracle where they're reaching out to all kinds of customers, even people who aren't currently Oracle customers, asking about their Java usage. Yeah. So, our recommendation is you should start looking at your own Java usage today and get compliant if you haven't purchased a subscription and you need to. But you don't need to go along with the high pressure sales tactics. Do your own analysis in your own time, figure out what you need, make your purchase, and move on at that point.
Very good. Well, I think we've covered most of the bases here, David. I know as we've talked to many of our clients, many of them feel that they may be able to put a handle on it themselves in terms of as we said, understanding the licensing, number one, validating their usage, which may require multiple tools. I'm not sure many of them know the legal perspective, so we'll share the blog from Pam here when we post this podcast, but any final thoughts for those using Java and what they need to do to ensure their quote unquote compliance?
Sure. Just a couple things. We do have there's a blog that Jeff Clemmie and I wrote back in early 2019. It has some details about situations where you don't need to license Java. For example, WebLogic server comes with Java. You don't need a separate subscription for that. There's a number of areas. There's also my Oracle support note that talks about that you want to look through. It's in that article. And then another one we'll want to let the listeners know about is one that one of my colleagues, Joe Grant, wrote a few months back. Okay. It's very short, but it has a list of all the versions of Java and the last free version and the first paid update. So you can use that table in there to figure out where you're at with Java.
Right. So it sounds like we've got some good assets out there to help make it simpler. It shouldn't be complicated, but Oracle's trying to make it so and try to maybe, get more money from their Oracle base. So in closing, David, you've been a thought leader around Java the last few years, both you and Jeff Clemmie. Really appreciate you helping our clients and the best practices for Java. And I'm very thankful for your participation here today. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks, Bob. Enjoy what I do. I like working on these types of things and helping our customers out and, helping them stay out of trouble.
Well, they appreciate you as well. We've come to the end of the House of Brick Partner podcast. For more information on what you've heard today or on other topics, please visit us at houseofbrick.com. Thanks for listening.